listening to Full Power Living with Eileen Dillon.
When I was a child of five, I was sent for a year to live with my grandparents on their farm. I got to relate to all the farm animals. I learned to milk a cow. I lay for hours in the pasture staring up into the puffy clouds. I fell asleep to croaking frogs, and I spent my days out of doors under the warm sunshine. And I always knew I learned a lot by being involved with nature, but not until I read The Emotional Lives of Animals and Children by my guest today, Dr. Bill Crane, did I begin to understand some of the demonstrable and measurable ways I was helped. We're talking today about animals, emotions, and children. Welcome to Full Power Living, where we bring you a wide variety of guests and programs to help you embrace and understand your own emotions. Please join us on our chat on the Blog Talk Radio chat or the EmotionalPro.com chat, and you can also call if you'd like to talk with me or Dr. Crane at 888-498-0570, 888-498-0570. Well, Professor William Crane is a psychology professor at the City College of New York. He's also a social activist and with his wife Ellen is founder of Safe Haven Farm Sanctuary and the East Hampton Group for Wildlife. And I'm going to leave pronouncing the name of your hometown to you. How do you say that? Poquag?
It's Poquag.
Poquag.
Poquag. Right. I guess it's an Indian name.
Well, Dr. Crane, whom you're now hearing, is author of child development textbooks and also of Reclaiming Childhood, Letting Children Be Children in Our Achievement-Oriented Society. Today, we're talking with him about his other book, The Emotional Lives of Animals and Children. And his you can get a hold of him at his website, which is safehavenfarmsanctuary.org. So, Dr. William Crane, it is my great pleasure to welcome you to Full Power Living.
It's great to talk to you.
Yeah. So just before we started, I was telling you that I had the pleasure of meeting Dr. Jeffrey Mason, and I want to start talking about him a little bit. I first had him on to talk about his book, When Elephants Weep, and since I'm interested in emotions, I realized that a lot of the stories he had in that book were describing how animals dealt with emotions. And I have since come to, especially when I'm talking about dealing with anger, I talk to people about how the other animals deal with anger. And I realize that most adults seem to feel themselves apart from animals, and they certainly don't think of themselves as an animal. But in your book, The Emotional Lives of Animals and Children, you share that children don't see this kind of separation, and it must be learned, apparently. Can you talk about that?
Yes. In our culture, we generally look down on animals and think of them as very different. The animal kingdom is a term we use to describe other species as if we are separate from it. And in fact, to call somebody an animal is usually quite an insult. It usually is preceded by a swear word, we consider ourselves higher than the other species. But children don't. Children seem to consider animals their full equals, they assume that animals will share in their activities. I did a little experiment with little test of this, because I just became so impressed by it that I just do a little pilot study, and I got some dolls and went to children of different ages and had a couple graduate students help me out, and we just we said, well, here's a boy and a girl doll, and they're thinking of inviting these they're just toys of goat and a sheep to a party. Do you think it's a good idea? And the younger children we interviewed, the 4 and 5 year olds, all thought it was a great idea. Just invite them, yeah. And they said, yeah, can I go to the party too? And they thought it would be nice. And the older kids, they started to learn, well, humans, they have their own lives and their own parties. And, you know, they say things like, I've been to parties and I've never seen dogs or animals there. And they were learning the social conventions that that we are separate.
Mm-hmm.
The children think of animals as companions, and they delight in them, and it's something that our society teaches us over the years to become more detached and to think of animals as mere animals and don't think too much of them. But in the on the farm sanctuary that we founded, I just became more and more impressed that of all the emotions that animals share with children. And that was a major reason for writing this book, The Emotional Lives of Animals and Children.
I know that many scientists, even today, are reluctant to believe that animals have emotions or to accept. They don't have scientific proof of it, apparently. If you have a form here on the earth, then you've got emotions. And when you've looked at the animals on the farm, part of what I understand you've concluded is that animals not only have emotions, but they share them and they teach them, and children are particularly open to what they are teaching. Is that correct?
Yes. The children are, they learn from the animals. I would say, you know, it's really ironic that we don't we separate ourselves from animals, because in psychology, one of the great advances in developmental psychology or child development was the work of John Bowlby, who was concerned in the 1950s with why children become so attached to parents, and when they separate from them, when they had to go to the hospital, how it was just terribly traumatic for children. In those days in England and the United States also, that parents were not allowed to visit their children in hospitals because of the fear of germs. But the kids, when separated, the two-year-olds, they just were so upset and became so depressed. And then they would say things like, my mommy's coming, I hear a squeak, that's my mommy coming. And it was just very distressing to go through that. And he pointed out that all animals, what he did is explain that, well, nobody had an explanation for this. He said, well, in other animals, they stayed near their parents. You look at lambs are staying near the mother, the ewes, and the ducklings are staying real close to the ducks. And every species you look at, practically, the little ones are staying close. And if that didn't happen, the little ones would be picked off by predators. It's a survival. And we're no different. Our human ancient history, there were predators around and kids had to stay near them. And so he explained that by turning to animals, and this is a major development, advance in psychology, and yet people, like, they act as if this theory that he developed called attachment theory was developed, like, strictly with humans, and they forget that he developed it by looking at animals. Uh-huh. So I was trying to do some more speculation, you know, looking at animals and thinking about the emotions I saw and how they might throw some light on human children, following in Bowlby's footsteps. So that's sort of one of the ironies of this topic you mentioned, which is why do we, you know, the problem with distancing ourselves and categorizing children in one category and animals in another. In fact, to speak of a child, you know, I had to rewrite some sentences because the accusation, are you really equating children with animals? I felt, oh, people might get upset.
Mm-hmm. I hear a kitty meow in the background.
Yes, yes.
Great.
When we take a break, I'll let her out.
That's great. So we know you're for real about animals. Well, so then you took some took that and you look in your book at six areas of emotion, and I wanted to talk about some of these areas. the areas that you identify are fear, play, freedom, care, spirituality, and resilience. And I wanted to start with care and have you talk with us about the Berkeley, California classroom that where the landscape architect put in a nature area. Tell us about that and what the effect was.
Yes. In the early 70s, Robin Moore, who was teaching in the in Berkeley, California, at the architecture school, he and the community in Berkeley thought that kids didn't have enough experience with the natural world, and they were able to take away asphalt, about a rather large portion of asphalt, and develop a nature area. Partly what they did is just put dirt and a pond in there and just watched what happened and see what animals colonized the area, you know, what fish came and birds came, and they kept it pretty wild. Parts were overgrown so that it wasn't all human designed, and the kids loved it, and the kids spent lots of time investigating the animals there, very patiently investigating the animals. And this is one of the examples of how children, you know, who are supposedly having attention problems in great numbers today, watching plants or looking at animals, they'll spend long stretches of time doing so, and they develop a power of patient observation in a natural setting like this. And in terms of caring, they started showing a lot of care for the animals. When they saw one injured, they took it in, and they were very upset, and they nursed it back to health, and then released the animal again. And when they saw other kids come in and throwing rocks and things, they defended the animals. One kid said, some kids came and started throwing rocks at a turtle, big kids, and me and my friend, we went out and got them to leave, because we should love all animals, and these protective feelings emerged. I think animals draw on children's protective and caring feelings more than almost anything else. And if we want caring adults, it's very important for children to have experience with animals. I'm not sure there's anything that draws out this capacity to care as much as animals, young animals. Kids have pets, but I think they need wider experience. I think that's very important.
I was thinking about that in terms of some of the social problems we're having now, especially as we identify it going with inner city youth. Mm-hmm. One of the things I've been concerned about is a dearth of empathy. It seems to me some of the rape situations, whatever that occur, or killing situations, you can't have feeling for the other person to do that. And we don't have empathy. What do you think would happen if we went on a campaign to put one of these little nature areas in every inner city community? It sounds like it would be helpful.
It would be tremendously helpful if this one, this hasn't been replicated too much. I know a little bit, but in the nature center that Moore developed, the nature yard, the boys and girls, instead of the fighting went way down. The kids didn't fight much, and the boys and girls played together. Often at this, in the elementary school ages, the boys and girls go on their separate ways, and you know, I don't like boys, they're dirty, and the girls say, and vice versa, and so on. They played together, and they were very calm with each other. They were peaceful. They sat around, talked, observed nature. They said it was a calming place. Nature makes kids feel good about each other. It makes them feel like they have a home. They spoke about it like nature was a really nurturing mother who takes children into her arms and soothes them and gets them to be nice to each other. And so I think in terms of what you ask about the aggression and feelings about, you know, the opposite sex and socializing with them and learning to enjoy each other rather than being apart, I think it would have a tremendous impact if kids had a nature-centered nature centers. We don't actually, this nature center in Berkeley was eventually torn down so kids could have, because they didn't want to keep funding it, and they and the school authorities were more interested in test scores.
Asphalt,
test scores, and organized sports. They lacked opportunities for organized sports, which is silly since they were still playing them. But that was
so
like
that leads into the next question I wanted to ask you about, though, because in your book you talk about the Lakota and a book that Standing Bear wrote. And Standing Bear says that the Lakota kids are allowed to roam around and follow their own interests, and they're not really instructed by adults, and that's what Maria Montessori also advocated in her follow child philosophy, that you're saying school authorities are, we want organized sports, when in fact children may connect better with each other and with nature, etc., if they are not organized by adults.
Yes, they are certainly over-organized today, and in children's competitive sports does a tremendous job of taking away children's free play and their freedom to innovate, and it's all very adult-directed. Coaches and Little League coaches are on the sidelines coaching. You have kids telling kids exactly what to do and giving directions. The kids become unimaginative. I actually got sucked into this when I was younger and became a Little League coach. And I remember one day, I always thought the kids were somehow stupid, you know, because they didn't play with any intelligence. And then at the end of the season, we had a picnic, and I said, why don't you kids just go play kickball, or I guess it was kickball with a ball, a game they played, and we adults sat on the side just relaxing. And suddenly I saw these same kids who I thought had no imagination in their play were highly creative. They were faking each other out and calling rules and calling, you know, different rules and laughing, and they were very skillful and clever when they were free of adult intervention.
I'm still stuck with what you were saying about the creativity of the kids. I have a 15-year-old grandson, and when I went to his older sister's graduation last June, before I went, I talked to him on the phone, and I said, what was the most exciting thing you learned in school this year? He was a freshman in high school. And he responded, he said, Grammy, school is not about getting excited about learning anything. School is about doing what the teacher tells you to do.
Right, right.
And it wouldn't have been heartbreaking if I haven't gotten that same kind of answer from a lot of kids.
It's all kids practically will tell you that. I went around asking them at one point, what about school? And they, you know, how do you like school? They look at me like I'm crazy. You know, they don't feel any freedom. They just feel they learn to obey orders. And do what they said and the teachers say. I made a comparison to Montessori in the book, The Emotional Lives of Animals and Children. I talked about the time we let the we have to confine the animals some because there's so many predators out that, and when we began the farm, the chickens we kept in pretty confined, and I increasingly experimented with giving them more and more freedom. And the chickens were so grouchy and angry all the time when this group of chickens that we began with. And I let them out, one day I just let them out and stood out in the rock for 2 hours. I mean, sat on the rock for 2 hours while they just went around foraging. And when they came back in, they came back in. They were calm, happy. Once they had the freedom, it just transformed them. once they had the freedom to do what they felt was natural, which is foraging around and pecking around for insects and digging in the soil. And then, you know, that's like what Montessori observed, Maria Montessori observed with kids. When they have the freedom to do things that are important to them, mm-hmm. not what the adults say, they work very hard on tasks and become peaceful and mm-hmm. happy. And I saw that in the chickens, and then I saw it elsewhere, and I thought, you know, it seems like it's the same thing going on. If you can trust kids enough to engage in the tasks that are really important to them, not the ones we decide, and not to give them so many orders, but let them work on their mm-hmm. own on it so they have a sense of independent mastery, that they will become happier. And if they're developing their powers, they will become happy. They're meant, you know, all species are meant to develop their powers. It's part of what we are. And when people are angry and annoyed and depressed, and kids are grouchy and stressed out, and I think a lot of the reason is that they're not getting this chance to develop their potentials.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Montessori was really, she was blind to some aspects of development, but she was really good on this, and also on this topic of freedom, and she also understood that children thrive in nature, that she knew that kids, there's something in kids that nature draws out the best in, and
right.
she made sure that kids had a lot of time in natural settings.
I know when I read that in your book, we're coming up to our first break here, but I just want to comment that what I thought of is the way that I've done psychotherapy for the last 40 years.
Mm-hmm.
Traditionally, psychotherapists are supposed to plan out the treatment plan, and what I learned to do instead was to follow what was coming up in my clients, and that seemed like it was more the natural way, and I appreciated your treatment of that because it helped me to see what I do also. We need to take a break. I've got more. I'm talking today with child psychologist, social activist, author, and professor Dr. William Crane, who is author of The Emotional Lives of Animals and Children. You can check him out at safehavenfarmsanctuary.org. We'll be back after this. As a parent, have you found all the parenting information you've been hearing lately a bit confusing? Are you having trouble sorting out the best response to your defiant child, or feeling hopeless about regaining respect from your teen, or determining whether your actions as a parent are the right ones? Instead of the usual pressures of parenting that you've been experiencing, you can partner with your child, raising incredible kids who are destined to become amazing adults. I'm Eileen Dillon, the Emotional Pro, giving you the opportunity to become the incredible parent for incredible kids. We have the method and the tools. You bring your optimism for learning and the kids. Raise Incredible Kids offers a comprehensive system for raising kids who are responsible, make their own great decisions, and become immune to peer pressure. To get you ready for this new era in parenting, get my free 10-page report, Incredible Communication That Helps You Create Incredible Kids, by visiting RaiseIncredibleKids.com now. That's RaiseIncredibleKids.com. Welcome back to Full Power Living. I have a few announcements. Next week, Mary O'Malley returns to talk with me about her book, The Gift of Our Compulsions. Many of us have compulsions. We shop, overeat, devour chocolate, drink alcohol, take drugs of one kind or another, or check 5 times to make sure we turned off the stove. And often we berate ourselves for having such compulsions. But Mary O'Malley says this only helps us stay connected with our compulsions, and she's worked out a better way in which she views compulsions. gifts as friends and gifts and suggests that we love our compulsions, which are working diligently to help us grow. So you'll certainly want to hear this. Excuse me. You'll certainly want to hear this show. Be sure to listen next Thursday, January 29th at 9 a.m. Pacific time. We also invite you to sign up at emotionalpro.com to be on our mailing list. I can share with you details for upcoming shows and information on relevant projects, especially concerning emotions. So we look forward to hearing from you at emotionalpro.com. We also have a free gift for you, which is a listing of the signals that seven common everyday emotions offer to you to help you with your growing. Just as compulsions help you to grow, so do emotions. My guest today is author, professor, and Farm Sanctuary founder, Dr. William Crane. He's talking to us from New York. And, Bill, before we get into our regular questions, your wife is a co-founder of the sanctuary, and you share two big areas of your life with Ellen, your wife. She's a pediatrician, if I'm correct, and started the sanctuary.
Ellen, I think, was... played a big role in starting the farm sanctuary. She was interested in farm sanctuaries, and when we saw a piece of land that we could afford, I thought, you know, this is something that she really would want to do. And she was a pediatrician, and she's a pretty a highly respected pediatrician. I mean, she's written major textbooks in emergency pediatrics and so on, and both of us wanted to do more for the animals. The more we learned about the treatment of animals today, and the factory farms and elsewhere, the more we thought we would do something. So she wanted to develop this farm. Also, when we began, we just bought the piece of land up on a hill. We didn't know hardly anything about what we were doing. If we could do it again, we'd buy not a hilly piece of land, but a flat piece of land where we could have more pasture, and not up high where it's so ice, where it snows. It snows up here. When down the road a half a mile, it's not snowing, because we get all kinds of bad weather, it seems to me. But anyhow, we've been, you know, learning as we go. Taking care of animals, we now have over 100, and taking care of animals is exhaustive work. And she made a huge sacrifice. She was an esteemed pediatrician in a public hospital at Einstein, a full professor at Einstein School of Medicine, and she decided to retire early in order to take care of the animals, to move up here and take care of the animals. We tried caretakers for a while, but that didn't work out. You really have to get involved yourself, is what we learned. I still teach because we need the money, and I think she's a little better at caretaking than I am, so I'm the one that goes into the city, commutes to the city, teach my classes while she's up here full time.
Nice. Thank you for sharing that.
Sure.
I want to look now at play and freedom, and I want to pose it in terms of, I have a 9-year-old granddaughter, and I have a 9-year-old granddaughter, and this year she's in fourth grade. I volunteered to do homework with her one night a week over Skype. And I have had the experience of working with this child for 2.5-3 hours, solid work, bathroom breaks only, and we're still not finished. And her dinner gets postponed, and she just has no time for herself during the week. And my heart aches for her, because I think she ought to have time to play, and she ought to have more freedom, but during the week she doesn't. And I want you to talk about freedom and play and the importance and what you've learned with the animals.
Yes. I think it's disgraceful. It's really cruel. I wouldn't hesitate to use that word. What the school systems are doing the children and forcing them to do so much homework. And at that grade, there's no evidence that it even helps. I mean, it's really a terrible thing, and it disrupts family lives. It makes children miserable, and kids are happy when they play. If we think back to our own childhood, when we engaged in free play, we were, I think most of our memories are very happy ones. And if you watch children, and children, I think, have a right to happiness as much as adults do. We think about children as always in terms of preparing them for some distant future where they'll be successful. Even if it doesn't work, we think we're preparing them as if their current lives don't matter, and they do. They have as much a right to the pursuit of happiness, which is in our founding documents as a country, as adults do. And when they play, when they have free play, they live better. They're less sulky and angry. They're less problematic for adults, and they're less angry, and they actually these opportunities actually help them intellectually. Ironically, kids who have opportunities to play actually do a little better in school, and they certainly become more creative. This is something that people say they would like is creative, innovative kids. In our farm, when we had a baby goat who was born on our farm named Boomer, I was amazed at how much he improvised from the first 6 days of life. He was jumping off rocks, but he was not just jumping off rocks. He was jumping and spinning in the air and spinning different angles. And one of the observers said, "How come he doesn't ever just jump? He always is trying some new stunt. And he's always innovating." And that's what kids do. They like to jump and run, and they innovate in their play. And they learn to innovate, and the capacity to innovate is what's made humans help us survive, you know, building new tools and building new things and we have an imagination. But I think it's deeply rooted in our animal nature. All animals play. All mammals studied so far play. I've seen little rabbits outside playing hide-and-seek, you know, and I've seen all of them. Some fish play. It seems to be in our evolutionary, certainly our mammalian nature. Mm-hmm. And so we're denying something that's very important to kids. And I think that the humans are probably the first, and Boomer's mother, Maddie, she didn't interfere with the Boomer's playing, running around. She kept an eye out on him, to make sure he was safe. But she didn't. She never would have intervened. I think we are the first species in which the adults are actually stepping in and stopping kids from playing. Partly, as you mentioned, through so much homework, just drudgery. And
I agree.
I hope people will go to school boards and, you know, get a few parents to speak out and.
My son pointed out to me that it's largely as a result of national policies that there's certain standards that the schools have to come up to, and to do that, this is the way they've chosen to do it.
Well, yes, that's a rationale. Almost every politician in the country believes in these standards, but finally there's some questioning. Of the standards. It's a case in which the adult politicians have decided what kids need to know and learn, and teachers have very little role in forming these standards.
Right, and children have even less.
Oh, children have no role at all.
Yeah.
And after about 3 decades of higher standards, we've still lagged behind everyone else. It's the country that leads the world in tests, ironically, is Finland. The mission of Finland is to give children a happy, creative childhood. And they have lots of breaks, and they think children need leisure. They don't have much homework in Finland. And they lead the world on the test as well as everything else. So the evidence does not point that it works. Yet we insist that we want to force our kids to to do what we think is best for them. I hope at some point I belong to the Alliance for Childhood, and I've did for years, and then Defending the Early Years, another group where we're trying to keep all this academic pressure, you know, keep it off for a while. Now kindergarten has become very academic,
right.
And play used to be the heart of kindergarten.
Yes.
It was a playful introduction to school. Now kindergarten is largely academics.
Yes.
Kids don't have recess much anymore, or it's very sharply curtailed.
Or organized.
Organized.
Well, I will say that fortunately for my granddaughter, her parents recognize she specifically really needs to connect with nature. So they bought a small cabin in the Sierras. Now, in your book, you talk about how play, not only does it bring us to greater creativity, but we also can master certain skills. We sort of like find our place in this world. Is that not so?
Through play.
Yes.
And and kids need the freedom to do that. A lot of kids, their futures are kind of mapped out for them, and we don't give them the freedom to find their place in the world. It's where I teach at the City College of New York. It's a real serious problem where the parents have they want the kids to be engineers because that's a high paying job. So the kids may not be interested in engineering, but. Or teachers, they don't know how to tell their parents that they want to do something else.
Right.
One young man wanted to go into acting, but he said, "I'm not telling my mom, she won't hear of it." And somebody said, "Well, why don't you just tell her?" Well, she wouldn't be able to hear it. And then some say, "Well, they'll cut off my money." And
right,
it's a serious problem in the. In working class culture, it's very serious. In middle class culture, we probably do the same thing. We assume our kids have to go to college. They have to go to the best college. They don't. I mean, the option of not going to college is, you know, it's not considered. And I'm not saying the kids should not go to college, but you know, it would be nice if they saw the reason for it themselves.
One of my children did not finish high school. And got an AA degree, and the other one got a master's degree. And I will say that the child who did not go to college has been more successful financially, at any rate, than the other one.
I'll be darned.
Yeah.
Yeah, there are success stories of students who don't go to college and or go... even drop out and go back. There's it's too bad because they feel bad about dropping out, and they.
Well, he didn't particularly, and you know he was in high school in 10th grade, and he started saying I'm not happy here. I'm not happy here, and we started talking about it. And I read a book on creativity when I was on a business trip. And I got off the plane, and I called my son, and I said, "I know what the problem is. Your creativity is being annihilated." And he said, "Thank you, Mom."
Oh, he really, that was so important to him, and he recognized that.
Right.
One of the great achievements of the 20th century in biology is called the Genome Project, with mapping out the genome. And one of the competitors in this, and I don't like his approach particularly, was Craig Venter, who wanted to make money off it. But he pressured, and was a tremendous innovator, and pressured his work helped get the results of mapping the human genome. There's no doubt about it. He barely stayed in high school, and he dropped out for a while, and he went to community college for a while because in Orange County. Orange Community College in California, because he wanted to be, he liked surfing. He wanted to be near some good waves, and he finally moved toward. But he said that one of the things that he felt was fortunate was that he didn't do too well in school, and schools never were able to drive out his creativity. He you know, he made racing cars and a water boat and other things while he was in high school. he flunked out, but he built a boat that could land in water. I mean, a little aeroplane, boat plane.
Uh-huh.
That could land on water. And he said he was fortunate that, like other kids, that school had not stomped out his creativity. And,
wow.
So it's, I think he did a great job. He did a great thing there with the boy.
When we come back, I know that your ducks showed you the importance of resilience.
Mm-hmm.
And so I want to talk about that when we come back.
Okay.
I'm talking today with Dr. Bill Crane, who's author of The Emotional Lives of Animal and Children. You're listening to Full Power Living, and we'll be right back. Do you know that emotionally, children form the foundation for their life during their first 7 years? Most adults just repeat that early emotional learning, good or bad, over and over for the rest of their lives. If you want to give your child an opportunity to live an emotionally masterful life, then join me, Eileen Dillon, also known as the Emotional Pro, for a free one-hour teleseminar on what it takes for your child to become an emotional master. You'll discover important things like what emotions are designed to do for us. Four things it's vital for parents to tell their children about emotions, and the single most important thing to do when someone is feeling emotion. Register now at RaiseIncredibleKids.com. The time has come for us to allow emotions their rightful place in our lives as the tools and helpers they're created to be. Find out what you need to know in order to give this vital information to your children so they can live emotionally masterful lives. Go now to RaiseIncredibleKids.com for your free Emotional Mastery Teleseminar. Welcome back to Full Power Living, as I'm talking with Dr. William Crane about the emotional lives of animals and children, and help your children connect with nature, and to help you do that, consider getting a copy of The Emotional Lives of Animals and Children. Also, I recommend that you visit Dr. Crane's website, safehavenfarmsanctuary.org. Particularly, look at the very short little video about Katie the chicken, and you'll see how compassionate some birds can be. I think that was just a charming, a wonderful video. So, Bill, before the break, I asked you about what your ducks showed you about resilience and how you learned what they did to help them be resilient.
Yeah, I learned many things from the ducks. There's a hunting club over the hill, which about a mile away, where they bring in ducks from a factory farm, and they're brought in boxes, and then as soon as they see the light of day, the hunters shoot them. They are guaranteed 15 ducks, the members of this hunting club. It's not fair hunting at all. It's just called a canned hunt. In any case, some of the ducks miraculously escape, and they've come over to our farm sanctuary. Most of them that were wandering around, and we've done a lot of things to try to steer them to a pond. We have a large, pretty large pond in the down below the farm. And at first, you know, they were like disorganized, but then they started and they were helpless, and they were. And then I watched over the months at how they became more and more organized, and they had. They actually, one time I noticed a leader. I didn't know. I thought one of the ducks was injured. I was trying to give them some food, and I noticed one of the ducks looked injured and was staying in the water, didn't come to eat any grain. And then as I kept watching, I noticed when that duck came over to the others and apparently said something to the others, the other ducks followed him back out to the water. And they were forming an organization, and looking injured, I think he was trying to detract my attention. It was a tactic animals sometimes do to t- take a bad person's, a bad animal's attention away. In any case, they became like a unit, and some big geese came to the pond, and they started dominating the feedings. They were pushing the ducks out of the way, and they're very big. And I thought, oh no, what's going to happen here? The ducks aren't even able to eat. And then I was surprised that one day the ducks kind of huddled in the middle of the pond, and then they flew as a group, like a squadron of planes. They flew as en masse, and the one group right at the geese and drove the geese up in the air, out of the way. And after that, the ducks and the geese formed some kind of truce where they shared the food. So how did these ducks, who started off so helpless, how are they overcoming their helplessness? And partly it was through, largely through forming an organization, forming a social organization, being part of something. And I think that they as they patrol and they deal with the challenges of life and try to protect ducklings, they work together. And so that made me appreciate the importance of the thought about, working, belonging to a group and working with others is important. My wife Ellen said that, you should say something about resilience and how what you learn from the ducks and how it applies to children. And as I read research on children who overcome adversity, a major factor is their participation in groups, like extracurricular activities, church groups, YMCA groups, other things, groups like that, helping around the house. So those who overcome adversity do a lot of the chores. They help take care of the younger ones. They get involved in sports. But they get some, I think they gain strength through a sense of belonging in groups, and that's an important variable that I learned. I hadn't really appreciated that as much. But the ducks gave me that insight.
Really? Yeah.
Yeah.
That sort of segues into another issue that just came up in the State of the Union speech, for example, and that is the concern that so many people have for the health of our Earth and what we humans are doing to it. And how many politicians are flatly denying that we humans have anything to do with it, that we have a problem or whatever. Most children, as you report, or a lot of children, get concerned about the Earth, and they get concerned about what's happening. They think that the Earth and animals have rights and deserve to be loved and cared for. Do you have any comment? What's happening the thought I had actually when I was reading it was, I'll bet you none of these politicians have spent much time in nature.
Yes, yes. If they were lucky enough to, they've forgotten. There's a great deal of evidence that kids are more concerned about the environment than their parents or adults initially, and certainly about animals. And when they find out that they're eating animals, actually, a lot of kids want to become vegetarians, and the parent, that's a crisis usually. It's if we could follow our early instincts, get back to our early instincts, let our own childhood lead us. This is an area where our compassion for animals, our empathy, it's in general, it's much stronger in childhood. And as we grow up, it's one of the things we lose, and we're taught to distance ourselves and be objective and rational, and we become too intelligent. We lose our emotional responsiveness to nature.
Well, I liked your discussion too, like in terms of us eating meat, for example, how in a way the society conspires to keep us from facing the fact of what we're doing. We don't eat flesh. We don't eat the body of an animal. We have veal. We have tenders. We have various things.
Yes. We even, proper grammar is to refer to animals as it. If you write an animal as, use the word who, a personal pronoun, rather than an impersonal one, your computer grammar check will note that you're using, making an error. So it's as if everything is disguised and objective, and most people don't even know what's happening to the animals in the meat that mm-hmm. from the source of the meat. The New York Times two days ago had an article on kind of a breakthrough article on the USDA, the government kind of work there. They're sponsoring with animals that is producing tremendous suffering.
Yes.
Did you see?
Yeah, we discussed it out here in California, how the animals
really
are crowded together.
Yeah.
Yeah,
and so it's been a long time. Children get very upset. I do a lot of advocacy. And I know when children find out, they don't even think about it. They say, protect the animals. What are you doing? Of course animals have rights. In fact, their moral thinking seems a little more advanced when they talk about animals than on other topics. They start talking about rights and respect and pointing out that humans are much like animals. These are surprising findings, the extent to which children, as you mentioned at the beginning of the show, how they see themselves similar to animals, and some kids said, well, yeah, you have to respect them. They have mouths. They may not talk like we do, but they have their own language, but they have mothers, and they, like we do, and they have eyes, and, they have emotions. We have to respect them. They're like, they know we're all animals. We have to be taught to become detached and contemptuous, and it hurts, because if our natural early empathy, if we could become more childlike, I think we would be better off. Sometimes
I agree. So now there is one more profound area that I want to get to before the end of the show, and that is about spirituality. And mm-hmm. I had never thought, you talk about your own experience, you talk about, you present a story about the minister, Howard Thurman, various mm-hmm. things like that, of this, and the farm animals gazing off just over the treetops, like on the horizon, as bringing peacefulness, connecting through a spiritual type experience. Will you talk about that for me?
Yes, that was another thing. Through my experience of the animals and then thinking about them in the book, it's been uncharted territory, and I was never brought up with much in the way of religious or education, and I didn't know much about spirituality, if anything, until fairly recently, and partly it was by just observing what kids in nature, how calm they feel and how they feel like they're part of, they get this feeling they're part of something much larger than themselves, that they're part of the web of life or nature, and this gives them great power. I think, as Howard Thurman says, that whatever society does and whatever troubles we have, he felt rooted in something much deeper and faster. He was an African-American minister who suffered a lot of prejudice, but he felt they could never really get to him because he was rooted in nature, existence, something more powerful. And the kids get this feeling in nature, and animals seem to have it, although we've barely begun to study this, but they seem to have that peacefulness and that feeling as they gaze off, that they belong to something much larger. They somehow nature's peacefulness comes to them, and I can feel it myself. Just being around animals after a while, they're so serene, and then the feeling of comes over me. It seems to pervade the environment. They seem to bring it out to humans if we would allow them. Children that understand that, mm-hmm. and these are feelings that are a little hard to describe, but they've been called spiritual by many people. Mm-hmm. The feeling of being longing to something more powerful, and this powerful, whatever this harmony or peace in the world comes into one. It's the green pastures and the still waters in the Old Testament. And
right.
This feeling of peace is in Western culture too, certainly, and
right.
in other cultures.
So certainly seems like something that that people who are suffering so much stress these days
yes.
would be well to make note of and to engage in. I hate to have to call this to a close. This has been a wonderful exploration. Bill, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Dr. Bill Grain's website is safehavenfarmsanctuary.org. And, Bill, I want to thank you for being you, for caring about the children and the animals of this world and sharing your observations and your concerns. And I wanted also to tell you that when I was reading your book, The Emotional Lives of Animals and Children, as well as talking with you now, I found myself feeling softer, kinder, and more open. And so I think your work is affirming of our very basic selves as we're rooted in nature along with the other creatures who live in nature. And so I just really want to thank you for bringing our attention to what we share and how we can benefit when we relate with nature and animals. And thank you for being with us here on Full Power Living today.
Well, thank you. It was wonderful doing this interview with you and sharing these thoughts with you. And I can tell that this is also something that you've been thinking about a lot yourself. And I love the anecdote of letting the boy, your boy, choose for himself.
Yes, yes, he did. He chose his own kindergarten too.
I love that. I think. I hope the listeners will heed every word of yours.
Good. Thank you. Thank you. All right. Thank you again. Next week, join me for my conversation with Mary O'Malley on a new and powerful way to work with compulsions, yours and mine. Be sure to listen on Thursday, January 29th at 9 a.m. Pacific Time, noon Eastern. Paul Johnston of Fresh Talk Media has been our producer. Thank you very much, Paul. And for now, I'm Eileen Dillon, your host, reminding you to pay attention not to what you want to overcome, but to what you want to become. Talk with you next week.
You're listening to Full Power Living with Eileen Dillon.